And now, in introducing Abner, there's no point in talking about Abner the philosopher or Abner the mathematician or Abner the physicist, since people have done that all along the way, and you've heard just about everything of that. But I just want to say, for my own part, I've known Abner for a long, long time, and the one feature that no one has mentioned is how lovable Abner is. As a charming, lovable human being, he's really something special. And the and the only way I can really characterize it is to say that, and this is true of very, very few people I know, but when Abner walks into a room, it lights up my day. Just seeing Abner is special. And he also, the one last feature I'll mention is that Abner has a lot of common sense, which very few philosophers, even fewer theoretical physicists like myself, and almost no mathematicians have. And I often use Abner for advice. And let me just give you one wonderful piece of advice he once gave me. And that is that I was visiting MIT on sabbatical in about 1980, and I wrote a piece on the Aharonov-Bohm effect, which I thought was, at that time they were debating whether or not it was real. And so I wrote a very simple little piece showing that it had to be real. And I was very, very happy with it, and I submitted. And I get back a scathing referee report. And the referee report, it talks about fiber bundles and cohomologies and all kinds of higher spaces. And he says, you know, this twit doesn't seem to understand any of it. He would seem to be offended by a nice, simple explanation. And worse than that, the thing that most bothered me is I had quoted Wu and Yang, and unfortunately, I hadn't looked it up, and I had made a slight mistake in my quote, and although it didn't change their meaning. But what he added at the end, he said he misquotes Wu and Yang. He says they said this, but they actually said that, and what they meant was this. So that really scared me. I said, how could that be Wu or Yang, such a nasty referee? I didn't believe it. I had just talked to Wu a couple of weeks before at Harvard, so I didn't think he would write such a thing. And I know that Yang is a gentleman and would never write such a thing, but I wasn't sure. And so I went to two of the big guns at MIT, and I said, and I laid it out. I said, look, here's the paper. It's obviously right, and so on, but look at this referee report. And so they both decided, now, look, right or wrong, Lee, you know, if it's Yang or not, you know, you just tell him he's crazy and ask for a new report. So that didn't sound too good to me either. So I went to Abner, and I told him, laid it out for him, and I told him the story, and I told him what these two big guns said. And Abner's standing there nodding his head no, shaking his head no. So I say, well, what's the matter? He says, look, you don't draw on the Lone Ranger. For those of you who are foreign, the Lone Ranger is the fastest gun in the West. And drawing on him is pulling your gun on him. So that was Abner's advice, which I took, and ultimately got the paper published, and found out many years later it wasn't Wu or Yang.
It wasn't the Lone Ranger.
And it wasn't the Lone Ranger. thank God in all cases. And at any rate, that's the kind of advice that one can get from Abner. Okay, so without further ado, here is our honoree.
Well, thank you. All the people who made this a
all the people who organized the meeting and who thought of it, came here. I am so grateful for so many friends, and I'm overwhelmed. You are really very sweet. I have one other thing that I want to say at the beginning, and that is an elderly man can't help but feel that there are many incomplete things in his life's work. And I feel that probably more than most people. But this conference gives me a way of ameliorating the situation. It allows me to list a number of problems that I worked on and thought about, made some progress, but not nearly enough. Now I can pass them on to my friends. And if not to you, then to your students and to your friends. And if you get answers, for heaven's sake, tell me about them. I would like to know the answers to these questions. So I have five groups of problems. Some of them have several parts. The first three are mathematical. Next to last one's experimental, and the fifth one is philosophical. The first mathematical question comes out of a paper by Wigner, and I give the reference. I give the references here. Oh, pardon me. I do want to say something first. Before that, I have forgotten about something very important. My talk has been given out, I hope, and if anybody doesn't have it, there are copies up here. That's one thing. Another thing that should have been given out, I believe has, is an announcement of a forthcoming book by Martin Egger called Science, Understanding, and Justice. He was a very close friend of mine. His widow asked me to edit his unpublished papers and scattered published papers, and she feared properly that his life's work would be lost if this were not done. And this was a labor of love. The book is out. I think it's a substantial book with many wonderful essays. I think libraries should have it. So I want to inform you about its existence, and you can look at the table of contents and see if there are papers in it that you would like to read. I found editing the book one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. Now I can return to the main topic of my lecture. The first of the problems on which I have only incomplete results was posed by Wigner, and he noticed that if one has an additive conserved quantity, that is, the conserved quantity has one contribution from the object of interest and another contribution from the apparatus, and you try to measure some quantity m, it cannot be done, according to his informal argument, unless that quantity commutes with the component of the additive conserved quantity belonging to the object. His argument was, for Wigner, a remarkably informal argument. And a somewhat more formal version of it was published by Yanasei and Araki very soon after Wigner's original publication. And then Howard Stein and I looked at that, and we felt that there still were some lapses in rigor that maybe we could fix up, and also some generalizations that we could achieve. So the generalizations are of two sorts. One is trying to extend their results to additive conserved quantities which are unbounded operators. Their results, when you do it rigorously, require that the operators are bounded by their techniques. And we wanted to get rid of that restriction on boundedness. The other is that they assumed non-distorting measurement. Non-distorting measurement is one in which the initial state of the apparatus, sorry, the initial state of the object, if you begin with an eigenstate of the quantity being measured, remains the same after the measurement is completed. So here it is. Here it is in essentially Yanisei and Araki's theorem. This is
our theorem, but with non-distorting measurement.
You see here, sigma is the initial state of the object, and here after the measurement is performed, it's still sigma, but the apparatus state is now an index of the eigenvalue in question. So this is not quite the strongest result we have, because it is non-distorting measurement, and we would like to know what happens if distortion occurs. Distortion can still be compatible with ideal measurement. In ideal measurement, one can repeat the measurement and get the same result. Well, for that purpose, all that's necessary is that the state of the object remains in the eigenspace of the observable that you have found. And if you measure the system in another state in that eigenspace, you still will get the same result. That's what von Neumann calls ideal measurement. So here we don't allow distortion. We require that the measurement is non-distorted. We also in this take care of the question of boundedness of the operators by working with the unitary operators generated by the additive conserved quantities. Here they are. It's the exponential IRL1, and also there's a similar one for IRL2. The unitary operators generated by unbounded operators are bounded, so one doesn't have to worry of whether that operator applied to an arbitrary vector in the vector space is meaningful or not. So we want to keep this treatment using unitary operators rather than the initial possibly unbounded conserved quantities. Then we got a somewhat more general result than that, and it is obtained by looking at this line here and replacing the scheme of measurement, replacing the this, that the unitary operator takes sigma cross eta 0 into sigma cross eta, replacing it by U takes the whole, it takes, now, for any, here it is, for any sigma in a eigenspace corresponding to some eigenvalue AM, there exists a finite dimensional subspace of that eigenspace, and the measurement procedure takes that finite dimensional subspace into itself. You don't go outside the finite dimensional subspace associated with the sigma. That's distorting. It could go into another quantum state, but it's still within that finite dimensional associated eigenspace. Now, there remains one open question. Can you remove that restriction of having to work with a finite dimensional subspace of the eigenspace? we worked like the devil on this, and we never were able to get an answer. I remember Wigner's comment, it's only epsilontics. But what does only mean? For him and for us, it's different. So I don't know the answer. And we worked till we were exhausted on the question. I leave it for somebody here. Now, I have to answer a question raised by Paul Bush in his lecture just a little while ago. He has what you might think is a relaxation of the measurement procedure, and therefore it may fill the gap that I have just pointed out. That's not quite true. He has given an example of unsharp measurements which are not bound by this result. If the unsharp measurements are used, then it's not necessary that the quantity being measured commutes with the additive conserved quantity. So my attitude to that result is it shows that this open mathematical question probably is not very important physically. It may be intriguing mathematically, and once a mathematical problem gets under your skin, it's very hard to let it go. I would like to know the answer, but I can't advertise the problem to you as one that is physically very important. I think that Paul's relaxation of the measurement procedure shows another way of doing measurements that will do all that a practical physicist is likely to need. That's the first problem. Now, the second problem concerns, now, I'm not sure I can get everything on here. The second problem concerns two-particle interferometry. And Mike Horn and Anton Zeilinger observed that when one has a pair of particles in an entangled state, and you do two-particle interferometry on it, you can also restrict your attention to only one of them and not pay attention to the counts on the other one, so you can do one particle interferometry as an alternative to analyzing the particle pair. When you do this, you look for fringe visibilities. Here is a source, and particle one comes out in one of two beams, that A and A prime. Particle two comes out in one of two beams, B and B prime. And you can insert phase shifters, arbitrary phase shifters, on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side. And if you insert the phase shifters, you will change the counting rate at these, here are the output beams, U1 and lower 1 and upper 1, and here is the lower 2 and upper 2. The counting rate at detectors in these output beams will vary as you vary the phase shifters. You will get maximum count. Let's restrict our attention to the upper beams on both sides. You find the maximum rate of detection in these upper output beams. And you find the lower one. And there are standard expressions in the single case for fringe visibility. Let me put this here. In the case of pairs, it's a little more complicated. So here is the... Let me do a preliminary step before doing this. Just a moment.
Here I've expressed the two-particle state in terms of the the two output beams, A and A prime, and B and B prime, and I've used all four states. But we know by a well-known theorem of Schmidt that you can always find a basis in which all you have to do is use two terms instead of four terms. That is a basis of C and C prime for particle one and D and D prime for particle two, and the same two-particle state can be expressed as some scalar times CD plus another scalar times C prime D prime. Easier to analyze when you use this the Schmidt form. Then you insert the various phase shifters, and you look for max and mins of the following quantity. Here is the again, I didn't tell you one thing. Alpha square is the maximum of detection in mu1, that's for particle 1, as you vary the phase shifters. Beta square is the minimum in that output beam as you vary the phase shifters. The visibility, but this is singles visibility, is alpha square minus beta square divided by alpha square plus beta square, which clearly is between 0 and 1. And Zeilinger and Horn notice that when this quantity is 1, so maximum possible visibility for singles, then the corresponding quantity, which I will get to fairly soon, for pairs is 0. And on the other hand, if this quantity is 0, a minimum, then the corresponding quantity for the pairs, the corresponding visibility for pairs, will be 1. So they only looked at the extreme cases. And then in my work with Weidman and Jaeger, we wanted to look at all possible cases, all the intermediates of not maximum visibility or minimum, but all in between. The most delicate question in this, and it's going to be important for the unsolved problem, is what is the right expression for visibility for pairs? And you want to really remove the contribution from singles and have only the contribution from correlation of the pairs remaining. So we had to play around with that. The obvious thing was to remove the product. We take the joint probability of getting detection in upper beam U1 for particle 1 and upper beam U2 for particle 2, and then subtract from that the product PU1 times PU2. That's obvious. If you do that and you stop at that point, you're not going to get anything interesting as a complementarity relation, because that quantity can go negative. That's not a very good quantity for a visibility. So we needed a correction to it, and Jaeger found the correction, which is 1/4. And there probably are some good general statistical reasons for doing the correction that way, but we haven't put our finger on that. But that's not the problem that I'm raising. So here, then, is a good candidate for a two-particle corrected joint probability. Now, put in this quantity, P bar, and you take the max minus the min divided by max plus min, and then you have a good expression for visibility of pairs. And now comes what we think is a quite beautiful complementarity result. And here it is at the very end, that the visibility squared for pairs plus the visibility squared for singles is unity. We first got an inequality that's equal or less than unity. And then it turned out that we could strengthen that to an equality. So for any, in other words, for any preparation of the two particles with two output beams on each side, the singles probabilities and the joint probabilities obey this complementarity with regard to visibilities. So that's accomplished. And by the way, the experiment was done by a group at the Photonics Center at Boston University, and it agrees very nicely with that result. Now, here's the question that was raised when I was for a month at Bristol University, which has a very strong quantum computation group. They think that this type of result is very important for quantum computation. What happens when you go from pairs to n tuples, or n greater than 2? Well, again, I put in about a month trying to generalize to 3. Couldn't get it. Mike Horn has gotten partial results, not a general result for 3, but special cases. And the special cases all look different. That is, when you inspect these special cases, you don't see a pattern emerging. So we're really puzzled. I bequeath this problem to you. This problem apparently is of real interest to quantum computation experts. I also can attest that it's a tricky problem. There's, in fact, a particular reason why it's tricky. Because as soon as you go beyond two particles in an entangled state, you get to 3, the mode of entanglement can vary. The topology of entanglement can vary. I think Anton once characterized two different types of entanglement of 3 particles. One, in one type, if you do a measurement on one of the particles, and so you reduce the wave factor, there are two particles remaining. They may be no longer entangled in a product state. But it is another kind of entanglement of the 3. You can do a measurement on one of them, and the other two remain entangled. So I think his term was entangled entanglement. My guess is, well, it's more than a guess, it's obvious that as soon as you go to n greater than 3, the variety of types of entanglement gets higher and higher, messier and messier. So you probably have a rather interesting topological problem to solve en route to getting this relation between visibility for singles, for doubles, for triples, for quadruples, etc. So my warning is, I think it's an interesting and quite useful problem, but probably very tricky indeed. So, third problem, the problem of obtaining definite measurement results. The problem of the reduction of wave packets. Now, you know, it's well known, this page, which you have for your consultation, is just presenting the measurement problem in a highly idealized case, where non-distorting measurement and if you start with a superposition of eigenstates with different eigenvalues, then the superposition is inherited by the joint system of object plus apparatus. So here it is. You end up with this term, in which the object is still in its original eigenstate, and a corresponding indexical term for the apparatus, and then a similar term for the other eigenvector. And then you say, where's a result? It's the Schrodinger cat for this system consisting of object plus apparatus. Now, there are lots of reactions to this idealization. And many people have said it's the idealization that has produced this ridiculous conflict between the formalism of quantum mechanics and the fact that one really does get results when one makes measurements. One doesn't have the pointer needle somehow in a superposition of pointing up and down. So removing the idealization properly should get rid of the problem. So here I've listed four strategies for removing the idealization. One is realistically describe the measurement apparatus as a initially not in a pure eigenstate, not in a pure quantum state, but rather in a mixture. Because after all, the apparatus is a macroscopic piece of apparatus in contact with its environment, and there are all sorts of interactions that will cause transitions from any given initial quantum state to neighboring states. So you really should describe the apparatus initially by a density matrix statistical operator. So one idealization that you can remove is not to use here that B0 as the initial state of the apparatus, but use instead a statistical operator. A second idealization to remove is the demand for precise measurement. You don't always need precise measurement. What you may need, and what may be much more important, is the ability to discriminate statistically between the case in which you've started with, a spin up in the z direction and another case in which you've started with spin down. And if you have an ensemble all prepared in the same way and you run them through, but you know they're all either spin up in the z direction or all down in the z direction, and the fact that your apparatus is in a mixed state shouldn't bother you. In maybe a large percentage of the cases, the components in the mixed state will yield the right answer, and a small percentage will yield the wrong answer. If you can discriminate between the two cases, between the statistics when you have spin up initially and statistics when you have spin down initially, that suffices. So here I'll read you the other two strategies. Relax the description of the measurement process. In particular, use positive operator positive operator valued measures, which Paul Bush is an expert on. Then a fourth is modify, really start playing games with the structure of quantum mechanics itself. Modify the assumption that the right mathematical structure for the quantum states is the Hilbert space structure. So let's see what results have been gotten with the first two. There are definite results. There's a claim for a definite result on the third, and the fourth is wide open. So here is a theorem. In which, initially, you take the apparatus state to be described by a statistical operator on Hilbert space H2 associated with the apparatus. And the only thing you demand is discriminability. If you start with an object in an eigenstate, let's call it A1, and here you've started with an object in an eigenstate A2, and then you add up the probabilities of getting, a needle pointing up for one, and the probabilities of getting a needle pointing up when you start with two, they differ. By ever so little, but they differ. So you can discriminate between the two starting points. That's about as weak a demand for measurement as you can think, this minimum kind of discriminability. Well, all right, those are the conditions you put upon the measuring apparatus. And then you ask, what happens now when you start with a superposition of a quantum state in with eigenvalue A1 and another quantum state with eigenvalue U2? Can you come out with a statistical operator for the joint system, object plus apparatus, which is diagonal in the apparatus observable, the indexical observable of the apparatus, the needle pointing, for example, that is diagonal, and it has no off-diagonal term. If that's so, then what you have at the conclusion of the physical part of the measurement is a mixture of situations in each of which the apparatus has a definite reading. There are no superpositions of needle pointing up or down. It's always needle pointing in a definite direction. But there will be some statistical distribution among these possible results. That would be a solution of the measurement problem in the sense that you have definite data. And, well, you know, I talked at the interview the other night, my philosophical position that a good worldview is one in which there's a closure of the circle of epistemology and ontology. Well, to do experimental science, you need data. To close the circle, the world must be such that data are available. If you have a peculiarity in the quantum mechanical formalism that prevents one from having data because measuring apparatus is oscillating, or it's in an indefinite state with regard to the values that it registers, no data, no closure of the circle. Bad. So the question is it possible, given these constraints that we started with on measuring an object when we know that the object is in an eigenstate of the observable in question, is it possible that at the end of the measurement, even if you start with a superposition of different eigenstates of the observable, you still end up with a situation, that is, the statistical operator, which describes apparatus that always shows a definite indexical value? And now I will not show you the proof, but here I give you the reference where the proof is given in physical rate physrev D, volume 4, and the answer is no. You never can do it. If you start with a superposition and these coefficients of the two orthogonal states, U1 and U2, are non-zero, you never can get this desirable final state of final statistical operator of apparatus plus observable. So this strategy of relaxing the conditions on the measuring apparatus simply doesn't give you back the data that you want. Now, Paul Bush and I did some work together, and this is really overwhelmingly Paul's work, in which we did a different sort of relaxation, not a relaxation on the type of apparatus, but a relaxation on the very concept of a measurement. The important step is this is done in our paper in two stages. One for general sharp observables, and then for the class of unsharp observables, which are associated with positive operator valued measures. Now, I gave out these papers, and the definition of these two sets of observables are given mathematically. I tried very hard to say informally what's in the mathematics. It's not easy. It was a good object lesson about how much clearer mathematical language is than ordinary language. The sharp observables, the ones that are associated with projection-valued measures, that I could say operationally pretty well. A projection-valued measure is a rule for partitioning an arbitrary quantum state into projections onto eigenspaces of some physical quantity of interest of the system, and then labeling these projected pieces with the eigenvalues associated with the eigenspaces. And that's what really the spectral theorem for self-adjoint operators says. That's relatively clear in ordinary language, though the mathematical expression is easier to understand. Now, here's the best I could do with positive operator. Is wrong. Positive operator valued measure. It is also a rule for partitioning an arbitrary quantum state and labeling the pieces, but in general, labeling with less information than eigenvalues, less than the whole truth, but not a distortion of the truth. And I showed that to Paul. And he said, that will do. That's close enough. And he tried to give a more precise informal definition of a positive operator valued measure. And the result would snow you even more than the mathematics. So it's best to either to read the mathematics or accept the hand-waving characterization. The main thing that I have to announce now is that the same theorem holds. Yeah, here is the result. By means of some auxiliary theorem, which we call the inheritance of superpositions, the theorem above, that you're not going to get a final statistical operator of object plus apparatus that is diagonal in the apparatus observable, that holds even when you replace projection valued measures by positive operator valued measures. In other words, when you go to unsharp observables. So that strategy also fails. You still don't solve the measurement problem, even though you've removed a further idealization of the measurement process. Now, here we come to another way of doing things. This is proposed by Machida and Namiki, and further elaboration of it by Araki. I give the references at the top of the page. And there's a good review article by Namiki and Pascasio. And what do? They say, your trouble in the theorem that I just reported to you, the theorem of Bush and myself, the trouble is you idealize the environment. The environment is enormously big, and you should not use a finite number of Hilbert spaces to describe it. You need an infinite number of Hilbert spaces, and in fact, you very likely need a continuum of Hilbert spaces. And their claim is, when you do that, then you get the result that is desirable from the standpoint of closing the circle of epistemology and ontology. That is, you get apparatus that is definitely in a, it is in one of many possible definite, the observables have definite values, though there may be a number of possibilities as to which values they have. Now, at this point, my problem, which I'm handing over to you, is first of all an assessment of their reasoning. I don't quite believe it. I believe there's some hand waving in it. And it's rather difficult mathematics, and I would like a really careful assessment. If they're right, it's a good result. It's an important result. But there's another place where you have to be careful. What if you try to use the result, but say that, as a matter of fact, you're only using a part of the environment, and therefore you don't use all of that continuum of Hilbert spaces. You use a finite subset of them. In which case, they claim, you get an approximation to a situation in which the apparatus observable is in one of several sharp values. What does that approximation mean? At this point, I raise a philosophical question. Not all quantities, when you go to limits, remain qualitatively the same. You can go to certain limits, and you go from regular points to singular points. You go when you have a situation which, in the limit, you have actual values. But before you get to the limit, you may not have actuality at all. You may still have potentialities, even though some of those potentialities have very small probabilities associated with them. The thing is, one has a philosophical problem of understanding what exactly is the relationship between potentiality and actuality. In ordinary usages of quantum mechanics, there's only one clear linkage. Probability 0 and probability 1, those extreme cases, correspond to actuality. That's the eigenvalue-reality link. Any probability other than those extremes are still potentialities. What happens in their theorem when you have a finite number rather than an infinite number of Hilbert spaces in the product to represent the environment? Do you have actualities, or do you still have a somewhat confused notion of potentiality? And that is one of the problems I leave for you. So that's the third problem. Here's the fourth. This is experimental. My colleague Ernesto Carnaldesi raised a number of years ago a conjecture that this connection between spin and statistics is not a kinematical matter, as you would think from Pauli's famous theorem connecting spin and statistics, but it's a dynamical matter. So that if you form a fresh ensemble of bosons, it may take a while before complete symmetrization sets in. It will set in because of interaction among the particles and because of the peculiarity of the Hamiltonian. If you take a fresh ensemble of electrons, it will again take a while before the interactions will give you the Pauli principle as a sort of equilibrium state. And he asked me, I remember his phrase, is this your cup of tea? Well, I'm interested in speculative questions, and I said, yes, if I can design an experiment, I would like to try it. I didn't know a good, clean experiment for bosons, but it seemed to me it should be possible to do a good experiment for testing the Pauli principle, to test whether the Pauli principle has an onset time. And so that if you catch the ensemble freshly enough, there will be many, many violations of the Pauli principle in the ensemble. And if you wait longer and longer, the percentage of violations of the Pauli principle will go down, presumably exponentially. Well, here is the experiment which I propose. I presented it in Vienna at a celebration for Anton Zeilinger last spring, and it uses a linear accelerator. I've never seen a linear accelerator, but I can talk about them. That's one of the nice things about being a theoretician. In this linear accelerator, one injects a beam of neon ions, singly ionized neon atoms. So 9 electrons per atom. And then one has an electron gun, like from an electron microscope, aimed at various points along the central beam here where the neon ions are progressing. And some of the electrons from the electron gun will be captured. When they're captured, when one of them is captured in one of the neon atoms, that's a fresh ensemble. Now it's a fresh ensemble with 10 electrons. So if Coronel Daisy is right, there is a non-negligible probability soon after the capture that the Pauli principle is not strictly valid in that ensemble. And if that's so, there is nothing to prevent the newly captured electron, and I can even talk about the newly captured electron as an individual, because without identity of particles, individuality remains. So the newly captured electron can tunnel down to the 1s level, and there will be three electrons in the lowest level. And of course, a photon will be emitted, which is a signal for this transition. So we want to aim the electron gun at various points along the beam. And then there are detectors here. I have some detectors very soon after the nearest point of intersection of the electron beam and the neon beam, and then further detectors further along. And we want to be able to manipulate the locus of this point X, that is the place of intersection of the two beams. And I have it here that the electron gun will be manipulated with a micrometer screw. My friend Sandeep Pescu says that's crude. Why don't you use piezoelectric effect, and you can move the electron, you can move the orientation of the electron gun, the angle at which it intersects, or you can move the location of the base of the electron gun in very, very small steps. And then we see whether the percentage of violations of the Pauli principle vary in this desirable, according to Coronel Daisy, a desirable way of indicating violations of the Pauli principle. So my problem that I'm leaving to you is, first of all, can you suggest refinements of this experiment? I say Popescu made one refinement. I'm sure other refinements are possible. The other is practical. Can you find me a good linear accelerator, and equipped with linear accelerator experts who are willing to do this experiment? Of course, the odds are overwhelming that the answer is going to be negative, that it's not, one's not going to find violations of the Pauli principle. But, you know, the stakes are very high. If you do find them, it will be a new world. So can you help me find somebody who'll do the experiment? So that's a problem of a different sort from the ones I've mentioned so far. Last problem. How should one treat the tension between the non-locality exhibited in careful experimental tests of Bell's inequality and the locality implicit in the special theory of relativity? Well, one of the favorite proposals for establishing peaceful coexistence between these two physical principles is that you cannot use quantum mechanical non-localities to send a message superluminally. That was proved independently by at least three people, three groups, Eberhard, Page, and the group Gherardi, Rimini, Weber. I give all the references here. John Bell, I was very attracted by that answer. It seems to me that's right. That's very good. There is non-locality, but you can't send a signal using it. Here is Bell's comment in an article called La Nouvelle Cuisine. It's reprinted in his in the second edition of his collection Speakable and Unspeakable in Quantum Mechanics. And here's what he says. It is often said that the experiment has decided against the locality inequality. Strictly, that's not too important. Do we then have to fall back on no signaling faster than light as the expression of the fundamental causal structure of contemporary theoretical physics? That is hard for me to accept. For one thing, we have lost the idea that correlations can be explained, or at least this idea awaits reformulation. More importantly, the no signaling notion rests on concepts which are desperately vague or vaguely applicable. Furthermore, I know from his way of talking that he thinks that reference to signaling is anthropocentric, whereas what he's talking about is a physical fact which is independent of human beings. So the assertion that, quote, we cannot signal faster than light immediately provokes the question, who do we think we are? We who can make measurements, or we who can manipulate external fields? We who can signal at all, even if not faster than light? Do we include chemists or only physicists, plants or only animals, pocket calculators or only mainframe computers? Well, John Bell was not only a great physicist, he was a great rhetorician. And I was pretty much bowled over by, by this argument. And I think that's right. It's not enough to say you can't send signals. Can't send signals by means of quantum non-locality. You still have a violation of the causal structure implicit in special relativity, and there is a real problem of living with it. So what do you do? Well, I think that's a really deep unsolved problem. I will mention one approach that seems to me attractive and very radical. It's attractive for other reasons than that it gives a way of living with the non-locality of quantum mechanics. And this is from some work of Michael Heller, who's a Polish physicist at Krakow. And here's what he says. The recent work on the non-commutative structure of singularities suggests that on the fundamental level, below the Planck scale, the concepts of space, time, and localization are meaningless, and that there is no distinction between singular and non-singular states of the universe. in spite of the fact that at this level there is no time, one can still meaningfully speak about dynamics, albeit in a generalized sense. Space-time and singularities appear only in the transition process to macroscopic physics. This idea, explored here in more detail, clearly favors an atemporal understanding of the creation of the world. He's also a theologian. So here are two references to papers of his. Now, why should I be attracted to this wild point of view? And I really do intend to spend quite a lot of time in the next few years on it. And I suggest that other people look at it and take it seriously. And I've listed here a number of attractive features of Michael Heller's approach to physics in the extreme microscopic domain. The first is that by abandoning the concepts of point and neighborhood, it offers a fundamental role to non-locality. In other words, non-locality in the extreme microscopic domain is not a phenomenon that rarely occurs when one does Bell-type experiments. It is pervasive in that domain. So the non-locality that we observe in the experiments that you've heard of at this conference is sort of the residue of this pervasive non-locality in the extreme microscopic domain. It's the residue that remains once you've gone through the correspondence limit of medium-sized phenomena. Secondly, by recovering ordinary space-time structures on a sufficiently large scale, atomic, nuclear, elementary particles, it promises a correspondence relation between the extreme microscopic physics and the physics of the ordinary physics that most of us are concerned with, atoms, nuclei, elementary particles, solid state, so on. Third, the conjunction of 1 and 2 may provide an answer to the problem that I've just posed, my fifth problem, the problem of peaceful coexistence of quantum mechanics and relativity theory. And four, you had a hint of it in the passage I read from Heller, that even though differential operators are not definable in the extreme microscopic domain, because you can't do it without the idea of neighborhoods and points, there's an algebraic surrogate for differential operators, algebraic operators which obey Leibniz's rule. That is, an operator operating on a product of f and g is af times g plus f times ag. And amazingly, and this turns out to be the case in the geometry that he uses, some kind of dynamics can be developed with this algebraic surrogate for differential operators. That I find very impressive. Five, this relates to some other things that we talked about at the conference. It endows the primitive world, the sub-microscopic world, with enough structure to permit the kind of evolutionary cosmic process envisaged by Peirce, Whitehead, Wheeler, and Smolin to take place. Maybe too briefly in the interview the other night, said that my trouble with this view that laws are products of evolution is that I don't see how the evolution can take place without some kind of proto-laws, laws governing the notion of spreading. And you can't have spreading without the idea of a nearby event being defined, and you can't have nearby without some sort of geometric structure, and therefore you have some primitive law to begin with. So this theory of Heller's may be minimal with regard to the lawful structure of the primitive universe, but enough. We don't need much for the evolutionary process to take place if we follow the biological model. Enough that somehow self-replicating groups of molecules can occur, and then let it all take place and give it enough time, and here we are. So, sex. Now, maybe this is fantasy. This primitive structure that remains in Heller's type of space-time may be capable of admitting a primitive part of temporality, namely transience, which we worried about in Savitt's talk the other day. Somehow, transience doesn't seem to occur in our normal physics, but it's certainly pervasive in our phenomenology. Maybe in this kind of primitive world, you can find a physical correlate for transience. One other thing. Now I put two question marks. Is it also hospitable to Whiteheadian proto-mentality? Well, that's a fantasy. It may be so, but I'm afraid I don't see how it could be so. And then finally, there is a practical matter which attracts me very much. The mathematics is manageable. There are, in fact, rather nice elementary expositions of non-commutative geometry. The book that I've been using is by Lundy, it's a Springer blog book. And it can be learned. And it's amusing in itself, and it may open new windows. So those are my problems, which I hand over to you. I want to conclude with some biblical commentary. In the book of Ecclesiastes, which is one of my favorite books in the Bible, there are two statements which are, I think, are beautiful, but I think they're wrong. One is the preacher, Koheleth, says, there is nothing new under the sun. He didn't come to this meeting. He would have heard a lot of things that are new under the sun. So that's wrong. The other thing that he says is, the eye is not filled with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. After 4 days of conference, the ear is filled with hearing. So that's my biblical commentary. Mainly, I want to thank you all for your gracious reception of me and the honor you've given. Thank you very much. No questions.
Fabulous.
All right. Enough been said. Thank you all.